love your work. On this show, we meet people who have carved out success by their own definition. I'm David Cadavy, best-selling author and entrepreneur. Today's guest, as far as I'm concerned, practically invented the internet. Steve Case. Steve Case was the founder and CEO of AOL, or America Online. Now, many of you probably chuckle when you see someone with an email address that ends in AOL.com, but for me and many millions of others, AOL was our first contact with the internet. I mean, I remember being a kid in Nebraska, connecting to the internet on dial-up, tying up the phone line, and just this rush of being able to chat with somebody that's like in Virginia or something. And you know, before that, the only people I really had contact with were who lived in my neighborhood or who I went to school with or who was in my Saturday morning bowling league. And suddenly I was connected to the whole world, and it was such an incredible experience. Now, Steve has a new book out called The Third Wave. The premise is that the first wave of the internet was building the infrastructure, things like getting computers with modems in people's homes, getting them on the internet with things like AOL. Then there was the second wave that was software focused. We built things like Facebook and Yelp and things like that. And now we have all that built out. It's time to change the more entrenched industries like healthcare, food, and government. That's the third wave. Now, Steve stresses that perseverance is going to be critical in the third wave, which is something for all of you lean startup practitioners to consider. You can't necessarily abandon your idea because you just didn't get traction right away. You also have to form partnerships, sometimes with big entrenched organizations that are slow moving. So opportunities to create something world changing by just writing a few lines of code, those are becoming a lot more scarce. And I really enjoyed the book, especially the parts about the early days of AOL. AOL had a huge impact in the 90s. And I remember flipping through channels and seeing Steve on CNN giving some kind of a Senate testimony. And I don't remember exactly what he said, but I just remember thinking that, wow, this is really next level stuff. At least it was to my 17-year-old brain. It was the first time I had any awareness of how entrepreneurs and technology really shape culture and shape humanity. And I hadn't realized before reading the book that AOL took about a decade to really get traction. So it was fascinating to read those stories of the perseverance that they used to get there. And that is going to be critical in the third wave. Now, I think Steve's theories about the third wave make a ton of sense. Thanks to having infrastructure, we had a good decade or so where our world was reinvented by software very rapidly. But now there are some really big challenges in changing really slower moving industries. And even if you're a solopreneur like me, even if you're an employee for life, even if you don't have interest in disrupting entrenched industries through, you know, VC scale companies and such, it's important to think about these larger trends and how they affect the world around you and how they affect your relevance in that world. It was a huge honor to interview Steve Case. He was one of those big guests that I didn't want to tell you about until I had it recorded, but here it is. Things are really picking up here at Love Your Work, by the way, on our 25th episode. I guess that's our silver episode. I have Jeff Goines, author of The Art of Work, coming up, and Tucker Max from Book in a Box coming up soon. So subscribe on iTunes so you don't miss those. And while you're at it, write a review. And here is Steve Case. This episode is brought to you by Treehouse. Take your career to the next level. Learn from over 1,000 videos created by expert teachers on web design, coding, business, and much more. Practice what you've learned through quizzes and interactive code challenges. Claim your 14-day free trial at cadavy.net/treehouse. You'll be supporting the show. I am here with Steve Case, the former CEO of AOL and the author of The Third Wave. Steve, can you tell us what The Third Wave is?
Well, The Third Wave really is the next wave of innovation around the internet and around technology and how it will impact our lives. And there's opportunities to really kind of disrupt some big industries of the economy. But just to set it up, just as a backdrop, the first wave of the internet was really building it and getting everybody connected to it, kind of building the on-ramps. When we started AOL, for example, in 1985, so 31 years ago, only 3% of people were connected, and they're only connected 1 hour a week. So, you know, getting America online, getting the world online was really the work of AOL and many other companies in that first wave. And it went from kind of 1985, nobody was connected, to 2000, everybody was connected, which then kind of set the path for the second wave, which is the last 15 years or so, which has really been building apps and services on top of the internet. So it's services like Google and apps like, you know, Twitter and Facebook and Waze and Snapchat and so forth. Those have really been the kind of where the epicenter of innovation has been in the second wave. And those kind of opportunities will continue. But the third wave really will start integrating the internet in things like healthcare and education and transportation and energy and even food, and in a way that will really, you know, create big opportunities for the innovators and challenge some of the incumbents. But the reason I wrote a book is I think this third wave will require a different mindset and require a different playbook than the second wave did.
Mm-hmm. So back in 1996, when I was a high school kid in Nebraska, tying up the phone line, using dial-up, getting on AOL, getting emails from the mayor of AOL, Steve Case, that was the first wave.
Correct. We were just trying to, you know, kind of, and again, I know it sounds a little crazy now, even people kind of listening to this, because the internet's now kind of part of everyday life. But, you know, in these early days, there's just a lot of work to kind of stand up the internet. A lot of, you know, how do you build the networks and the software and the servers and create the content and drive the adoption of it. And that first wave was mostly about PCs, mostly about people connecting through phone lines, as you mentioned. And, you know, there was a lot of work to really make that happen. I used to joke that AOL was sort of a 10-year in the making overnight success. By the time we really, you know, kind of were visible in the mid-90s, people thought we came out of nowhere. But in the reality, we've been working at it for a decade to kind of build the company and build the internet as really a platform.
Yeah, and that was something that I noticed in your book, was I hadn't realized how much work and how much perseverance it took for you to make AOL happen. I mean, you started, like you said, in 1985. I think you were, it was before it was quantum computing services. Was it something else before that?
We started in 1985 because we didn't have much venture capital. We were only able to raise about $1 million of venture capital. We decided to partner with other companies. So we created essentially private label or white label services with Commodore and Apple and Tandy and IBM. And so it wasn't until, you know, about 1990 that we really launched America Online, which became AOL as sort of our own, you know, service. And so those first 5 years or so really was just a lot of blocking and tackling to form these partnerships and launch these services, really leveraging other people's brands, other people's distribution. And then we were able to stand on our own 2 feet and with America Online. And when we launched that in, around 1990.
Oh, sorry. I thought that you were adding a number on the end of 1990.
That was where we launched that as our own essentially independent brand. But in retrospect, the reason it took so long, and it really took a decade, is it's time when I was, you know, doing it. I was in my mid-20s at the time, so I just thought the idea was obvious that everybody would get connected. And you know, I was surprised that it took so long. It was such a slog. But in retrospect, it's easier to see, because back then, most people didn't have PCs. Most of the people who had PCs didn't have modems to connect. Most of the people who had modems and PCs, you know, couldn't afford the $10 an hour it often cost to be connected. You know, it was a kind of a hassle and hard to get connected, and there wasn't much to do when you did get connected. So, you know, it just took us a decade to, you know, to kind of make it easier to use and more useful and more fun and more affordable. So it really was kind of ready for prime time, ready for more of a kind of mainstream, you know, kind of audience. And that was one of the lessons I learned in that first wave. Sometimes revolutions happen in more evolutionary ways, and sometimes you just need, you know, perseverance to stick with it, because some of these challenges, some of these opportunities are hard. They're going to take time, and you kind of have to keep at it.
Yeah, I was amazed at some of the people that you were surrounded by. For example, the story about the fellow who was trying to start through Atari, something where you could dial up and download games and play the games on Atari through a phone line. And this was in, you know, early 80s or something like that. Basically,
right. It was very innovative. He was basically, because back then most people didn't have PCs, but a lot of people had those Atari game machines. His idea was, you know, create essentially what looked like a game Atari game cartridge, but actually was a communications modem. So you'd plug it into your phone line and then be able to turn it into more of a two-way terminal and be able to download games. So it's a little bit like Netflix is now for movies. That's what it really envisioned 35 years ago with this product called Game Line. So there were a lot of that ended up not succeeding because just as that product was coming to market, the interest in the Atari games machine kind of plummeted. So the company kind of was suddenly in kind of free fall. But that was an example of one of the pioneering attempts early on, you know, to essentially create this digital age, create this what we now think of as the internet age, by figuring out ways to kind of enter the market with the devices that were popular at the time.
I also really enjoyed the stories about making AOL accessible. I mean, you had like these different services that you had come up with before, but it took many years to finally come up with this idea of America Online and having the voice of, you know, welcome, you've got mail and all of that. And it sounded like you had learned a lot from working at Procter & Gamble and Pizza Hut before in terms of understanding how to make something approachable to a consumer. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. No, I think they are both great experiences. I graduated from college in 1980, and at the time, I actually wanted to pursue the internet. I read a book while I was in college by Alvin Toffler called The Third Way, the same name as my book. I was really mesmerized by his vision for the future, essentially outlining back then what we now think of as the internet. But when I graduated in 1980, there really weren't any internet companies to go to, and there wasn't much of a startup culture back then. So that's why I decided to work for some big companies for a while. And so I worked for a couple of years at Procter & Gamble in Cincinnati, and then for a year at Pizza Hut, which at the time was a division of PepsiCo. I learned a lot at both companies, even though I was there a short period of time. One of the things I did learn at P&G was how they use market research to really understand consumer preferences, and how they also use things like sampling of products to get people to try the product. So if they were launching a new shampoo, for example, they'd have little packets of shampoo that they might bundle with newspapers or send you by mail. And that inspired us a few years later when we were trying to accelerate the growth of AOL to distribute free trial discs to make it easy for people to, you know, try the service. So it's kind of, that was a lesson I learned from P&G. And one of the lessons I learned from Pizza Hut was, how do you keep things, you know, simple and focus on convenience? That they really were focused on trying to be a kind of a mainstream brand. I think they had something like 5,000 Pizza Huts at the time. Most of the chefs were, you know, 16, 17-year-old kids who, you know, didn't have a lot of experience, culinary skills. So how do you create things that could be distributed broadly and available kind of, you know, broadly? So there are different lessons that, and one of the things we focused back then on is, again, the early 80s. You know, pizza was focused at the time on delivery. Of course, now most of the pizza places do have delivery, but back then it was sort of a novel, you know, concept. So the convenience that and simplicity that Pizza focused on, the sampling, the marketing efforts that P&G focused on were helpful as I then moved onto my entrepreneurial journey as a co-founder of AOL and a few years later in 1985.
So this is a little bit of a tangent, but I'm very curious. You were director of new pizza development, correct?
Right.
And so were there examples of pizza ideas that you came up with that you had trouble getting the less trained employees to be able to actually execute?
Oh, yeah, there was part of what I was doing was because we believed that the innovation wasn't just going to be at our test kitchen, which happened to be in Wichita, Kansas, but there were you know, tens of thousands of independent pizza places all around the, you know, the country, and some of them likely had some innovative products. So maybe rather than sit in Wichita, we should hit the road and learn from what's happening out there. So I spent a lot of time traveling around. And often would find something that in a particular city that was interesting, but then to figure out a way to replicate that in 5,000 places with untrained chefs, you know, was definitely a challenge. And so most of the things that we thought were good ideas ended up not really fitting with the Pizza Hut model.
It's interesting. So you building the first wave If I can credit you with that, I know there are other people involved, but I mean, I would have to argue that you had a pretty big influence in that. You were using these skills that you had from working in these larger organizations, working at scale, working on making products approachable to consumers. And, you know, once that first wave was over, it just like opened up the floodgates for the second wave, where now you've got people starting companies in their dorm rooms and having multi-million dollar valuations practically overnight and such. But now that we've got that infrastructure, we've got more people, everybody's on the internet, and that second wave has come. Now it's going to be the hard slog again a little bit in this third wave, it sounds like.
Yeah.
Is that accurate?
I think first of all, there were a lot of people who were part of that first wave and contributed to making it happen, both within AOL as well as many other companies that were critical in parts of that. Really, hundreds of companies were part of that first wave, and
sure,
that's why partnership is so important. And, you know, the second wave, there were a lot of overnight successes, like, you know, as you say, kind of dorm room startup, whether it be Facebook or Snapchat. That's not to say that it wasn't challenging for them, or in some cases it, you know, was, you know, a longer slog, but there were certainly many examples of kind of overnight successes in the second wave. And I do think that will be rarer in the third wave. I think if you're really trying to revolutionize a sector like healthcare, it's not just about the app. It's also about how you integrate that technology into, you know, hospitals. And if you really want to change, you know, kind of education, it's not just about, you know, the kind of learning you can do on your tablet. It's also about how you work with teachers in classrooms to create a more active, engaged, personalized, adaptive approach to, you know, learning that's really more for each kid, depending on their learning preferences and styles and so forth. So I think it's going to require, you know, more perseverance. I think it's going to require more partnerships, and it's going to require more engagement on policy, what I call in the book the three P's, because most of these sectors are regulated. And so dealing with regulations, even if though it's challenging and frustrating, you know, sometimes for innovators, is going to become much more important. So I just think that's why I decided to write the book. I think that the mindset and the playbook needs to be different from the, you know, in the third wave, different from the second wave, but have some similarities to the first wave. Those three P's around partnership and policy and perseverance really were critical in the first wave, not as critical in the second wave, will be critical again in the third wave.
Now, I can't help but think, as I think about trying to create innovation in healthcare and education and food, that some of those industries are very entrenched, and there's maybe, or government, for example, as well, that it's just going to be really hard to get them to cooperate, that there's going to be a cultural clash if you're an entrepreneur trying to play nice with these
That's
companies
true.
In that
That's
industry.
True. It's going to be hard. There will be a culture clash. It will be frustrating. But I think the successful innovators in the third wave will figure that out. By the way, it's going to require, you know, both sides to dance. I mean, part of my argument in the book is, you know, the entrepreneurs of startups will need to figure out ways to partner with the larger organizations, and whether it be companies or nonprofits or what have you, to really have significant impact in these sectors. But it's also incumbent on the larger companies to partner with the entrepreneurs. A lot of the innovations are going to happen outside their companies, outside their, you know, their industries, and they need to understand that, and they need to be the companies that are successful now will continue to be successful only if they adopt a new strategy around innovation and try to build almost a network around their company, recognizing that while they, I'm sure, have smart people working for them, a lot more smart people aren't working for them. They're working for somebody else, and they need to figure out some way to tap into that energy and those those ideas. So I think that's why partnership is going to be, you know, so critical in the third wave. It's going to be critical for the entrepreneurs, and it's going to be critical for the larger companies, and the ones that figure that out and do that well, I think, will be the winners in the third wave. And it will require a little different skill set, because the second wave was, because it was mostly about the software, mostly about the app, it was mostly about engineering and coding, and that will continue to obviously be important in the third wave. But some of the people skills, I think, and to really build relationships, to forge partnerships, to engage with governments on, you know, policy issues, I think those skills will become more important as well in the third wave. And I think what it really argues for is diverse teams in the third wave that bring different perspectives, different worldviews, you know, different competencies, different credibility, to really kind of, you know, give some of the ideas in the third wave real momentum and kind of liftoff.
Now, when you talk about partnerships, I can't help but think about a story that was powerful to me in the book, where you talked about that you went and rented an apartment in San Francisco and then visited the Apple campus every day for like 6 months to try to form a partnership with them, right? Early before AOL, before AOL right. was AOL, right?
Right.
And
yeah, we thought that Apple was a critical, kind of potential partner. We had identified them as the most important partner. We said if we could establish a partnership with Apple to create a joint service, which we ended up calling Apple Inc. Personal Edition, that would be a game changer for our company. And so even though we were based in Washington, D.C., as you said, I did essentially move out. I didn't think it was going to be for 6 months, you know, but it ended up being for 6 months. And showed up at Apple every day and kept talking to different groups and trying to, you know, kind of weasel my way into the company and figure out somebody there who could say yes, that, you know, could agree to a partnership, and, you know, talk to different groups. And some said no, many said no, but finally one said yes, which was the customer support group. And we agreed to create a service that would focus on providing online customer support that would be more efficient for them than just people making phone calls to them. And in addition to that, we'd add some other services. So that was the, you know, we finally had a breakthrough. We finally found a group within Apple that liked the idea and was willing to, you know, to partner with us. But it took a lot of time. And if we just flown out there for a couple of days, we never would have had that partnership. It required really making it a priority and sticking with it and persevering until finally we got somebody to say yes.
Were there any particular characteristics that you were able to define on how you could figure out who within the company was willing to play nice and partner with you as you explored that might work in the third wave as well?
Sure. I think there are a couple ingredients there. You know, one was kind of going to school on the company and the different divisions and trying to understand what some of the challenges they're dealing with were, some of the opportunities they might be interested in might be, kind of putting yourself in their shoes and trying to kind of understand kind of how they might be thinking. And that then makes it easier to craft a pitch around a partnership, because it's likelier to resonate with them if it's in sync with the way they're thinking. And so, you know, required some research, talking to a bunch of people to try to understand what different groups might be, you know, motivated by, interested in, kind of moved by. And the second was really the issue of persistence and just, you know, not taking no for an answer. And if somebody in some group said no, asking them to introduce me to somebody else in some other group, and, you know, eventually find a place that, you know, person or group that was, you know, willing to, you know, say yes. So I think the first was kind of a little bit of a research aspect, a little bit of an empathy aspect, a little bit of a just kind of going to school to understand how they might be, different groups within the company might be thinking. And the other was kind of persevering and finally finding out some path to, you know, to a yes. I think those, you know, skills are going to become important and more important in the third wave, because I don't think it's going to be easy if you have an idea for revolutionizing healthcare to, you know, get a meeting with the right person at the, you know, the Cleveland Clinic or the United Health Group or other folks. It's, you know, it's going to be hard, and you have to figure out some way to break in, some way to, you know, get some attention, get some notice, and get some, you know, build some credibility. And you know, I think it, you know, it won't be easy to get in. It won't be easy to form the partnership. It won't be easy to execute against the partnership. It won't be easy to keep both sides happy. But you know, if you have the right, you know, skill set and the right perseverance, and you structure it as something that can be a win-win kind of relationship, then you have a real shot.
And I've got to wonder, how did you get security clearance to wander around Apple every day?
Well, it was really two phases. The first phase, first month or two, I would just basically go there and register, you know, every day as a guest. And I, you know, somebody else I was, you know, trying to meet based on, you know, somebody suggested. And after a little while, you know, I think they got tired of that. And so they actually, I convinced somebody to get me a consultant badge, so I then could enter on my own. And I, you know, kind of found an empty cubicle and sort of, you know, parked myself there.
I wandered around the hallway.
Yeah, for a couple of months, and a little bit wandering around the hallway. So, you know, maybe, yeah, you know, I suspect I know the Apple security is much more intense these days, but they were, you know, flexible, a little more flexible back then.
Yeah, and it sounds like one of the, you know, like the killer app of AOL was community. That really getting, that's one of the reasons why you succeeded over CompuServe or Prodigy, was that AOL was approachable and you built community there. And so it was kind of like power to the people kind of thing. What sort of element might that sort of thing play in the third wave in getting these more entrenched industries to change?
Well, I think I agree with that. I think there's several aspects. So I think the key thing we did better than most others back then was partnerships. And we had hundreds of partnerships with communications companies and hardware companies and software companies and content companies and commerce companies and, you know, a lot of different partnerships. And we would not have been successful without the partnerships, is why I focus on that theme and the third wave. The second was trying to make it really easy. The internet back then was hard and threatening and frustrating and expensive. And a little scary. And so we were really trying to kind of make it really easy to use and useful and fun and affordable. But the third, as you mentioned, was we bet early on, really on day one, that the killer app of the internet was people. It was what we called community. So we focused on things like people connection, which were chat rooms, and instant messaging, which we created, and buddy lists, which we created, things that were ways to people to stay connected to people they already knew, friends, family, but also to connect to people they don't know, but would be interested in knowing because they had some kind of shared interest around sports or stamps or whatever it might be. And so that community focus really was sort of the heart and soul of our efforts at AOL. And it turned out that really was the heart and soul of the internet. It was sort of was the killer app. It was almost the soul of the internet was people and interaction. You know, we called it community. Now it's called social and social networks, whether it be Facebook or others are building on some of those ideas around people, those ideas around community. So, it was really, I think we broke through in part because of the partnerships, in part because of the focus on simplicity, really making it ready for prime time, in part because of the focus on people and community, as well as in part because of the willingness to persevere and stick with it for really a decade before we finally broke through.
And I have a few questions that we're running out of time here, so I have a few questions that I kind of ask all of the guests that I'd like to run through.
Okay.
First off, what's the biggest compromise that you've had to make to get where you are?
Good question. I think probably the biggest compromise was when we decided it made sense strategically to merge AOL with a larger company, and we ended up merging with Time Warner to enable that deal to go forward. I agreed to step down as CEO, so kind of stepping aside, from AOL and from something that I helped birth, was kind of a compromise that was necessary in order for that merger to happen. And we concluded that merger because AOL had gone from a $70 million value when we went public in 1992 to a $160 billion value 8 years later, that it did make sense to merge with a larger company that would give us a more diversified mix of businesses. So I think it was right strategically, but it was a compromise in terms of my willingness to kind of step aside.
Yeah, it's interesting that kind of some of the problems that happened with that merger were people and maybe culture clashes and such. And those are some of the very most difficult impediments in the third wave as well.
Yeah, absolutely. That's one of the lessons I learned, obviously the hard way. And that's why I devoted probably the longest chapter in the book to sort of the lessons learned around the merger, which essentially, as you say, was around, people and culture. The idea of the merger made sense, the execution didn't. And I love this Thomas Edison quote, which I reference a lot, which is vision without execution is hallucination. So it's one thing to say, as we did, 15, 16 years ago, when we announced the merger of AOL and Time Warner, that we're going to lead the way on digital music. Remember, this is, 5+ years before Apple even launched the iPod and entered digital music. And our company, because AOL was the largest internet platform and Time Warner owned Time Warner Cable, the largest broadband system, and owned Warner Music, the largest music company, how could that company not lead the way in digital music? But the reality is it didn't, because it wasn't able to work together, wasn't able to build bridges across those different divisions. They really all operated autonomously. And that lesson around people and culture, and that lesson around the importance to not just have the idea, not just have the vision, but have the execution, which requires the right people in the right places working together in the right ways, is one of the key lessons. And I think it's going to become critical in the third wave. These are tough challenges, some of the sectors that are ripe for disruption, and it's why it's going to require this different mindset.
Right. And in the from the Department of Non Sequiturs, do you make your bed?
Do I make my bed?
Yeah.
Well, right now I'm in a hotel room and it's unmade. So I guess the answer is sometimes I do and sometimes I don't.
Okay. It's not a ritual for you. Not some sort of a habit that you have.
No.
Do you have a final message for any of our listeners?
I think the closing message would be, I think this third wave, creates all kinds of interesting opportunities, but also is going to create some challenges. That's not just true for companies. That's true for each of us as individuals, each of us as citizens. Even the nature of work itself has changed a lot. There's some research that suggests that 34% of people now feel like they're part of the freelance economy. And so as you think about this third wave, it's not just about what the technology might enable or what some of the entrepreneurs and big, they are part of, kind of well-funded startups might be focusing on, or what some of the big companies, the incumbents might be focused on. It's how each of us as individuals, chooses to live our lives and kind of pursue our dreams. And I was inspired when I read that Alvin Toffler book, The Third Wave, when I was a senior in college in 1980. And I just hope others out there might be similarly inspired to think about the future in a different way by reading my book, The Third Wave, because the hope here is, and the goal of it was not just to write a book for entrepreneurs or even for business people, but for people just wanting to have a sense of where the world was going and have a little bit more clarity regarding what options they might have, and hopefully take some of that insight, take some of that understanding to make a different set of decisions that will position them better for the next 10 or 20 years, and also position their families to be better off 10 or 20 years from now.
And for all those listeners out there for whom your message resonates, which I'm sure there will be many, where can they find more of you and your message?
Well, we do have a site about the book called thirdwavebook.com. And there's several other sites that are available. One is revolution.com, which is our investment company. Another is casefoundation.org, which talks about our philanthropic work, including around entrepreneurship. And finally, we have a site called riseofrest.com. We believe one of the great opportunities in the third wave is regional entrepreneurship. But the action not going to just be in places like Silicon Valley and New York City. It's going to be all across the country, indeed all across the world. So we have a whole initiative around what we call the Rise the Rest to support entrepreneurs in all across the country and in cities that are really showing remarkable momentum around startups.
Well, thank you so much for coming on and talking about the third wave today. And I also, before you go, I have to sincerely thank you so much for starting AOL and getting me on the internet. And I'm sure this is true for so many people out there. For as an isolated kid in Nebraska, to be able to connect with people all over the world and to make my first web page and all these things, it was really powerful for me.
Well, that's great. Obviously, our goal there was to kind of level the playing field so everybody had access. It was sort of, we called it democratizing access to information by making the internet available everywhere. Now our focus is really democratizing access to entrepreneurship and opportunity, including initiatives like the Rise of Rest. And places like Nebraska, like Lincoln, are showing great momentum, but so are places like Des Moines and Madison and Detroit and Nashville and many other, Richmond, Charleston, many great cities in this country are building up as entrepreneurial zones. And that's going to accelerate as this rest rises and accelerate as the third wave breaks.
Well, and actually, because all that infrastructure is there, I'm able to make this call to you from Colombia. I'm in South America right now. So
exactly right. Well, this is exactly the point that, you started in Nebraska and connected through a, relatively slow dial-up telephone modem,
2400 baud,
and now you're able to connect all over the world, and now you kind of are able essentially to be your own media brand because that opportunity was enabled by the internet.
Great, thanks so much. Hey, do you ever buy anything from Amazon? If you do, I think you might want to take the Love Your Work listener survey. I want to hear what you think about the show, and I'm giving away an Amazon gift card to one lucky respondent. Maybe it's going to be you. The survey is only 4 questions long, You take the survey at cadavy.net/survey. Do it before 11:59:59 p.m. GMT on Wednesday, May 18th, 2006. What I'm trying to say is before midnight on Wednesday, May 18th, GMT time. Take the survey there for a chance to win the Amazon gift card. That's cadavy.net/survey. Thank you. And before I go, I've got to ask, do you like books? If you do, I'd love to send you my book recommendations. About 90% of them will be nonfiction on subjects spanning from biographies to neuroscience. Just go to cadavy.net/reading, sign up, and you'll get my first set of book recommendations right away. You'll be supporting the show if you buy any of those books through the links in the email. This has been Love Your Work, and I'm David Cadavy. The theme music for the show is See In You, performed by The Album Leaf, courtesy of Sub Pop Records. Love Your Work is a production of Cadavy, Inc.